Okay, good morning, everybody, and welcome to BIO 241. It is April 26th, and it's Thursday, right? You guys usually correct me when I say Wednesday, so Thursday, I got it right this time. And I'm looking at the syllabus. It's okay if you guys don't listen to this, because it's only the test material, so it's not too important, okay? So we're going to finish up Blood, Heart, and Circulation, which is chapter 13. All right, and today's the 26th, so that means we have two lectures before the next exam. That is on May 8th. That's a Tuesday. All right, so we got two lectures, and it's going to take me one lecture today to get through 13. That means I have one lecture to cover chapter 14, and I've got three here scheduled. So I guess it's painfully obvious to me that chapter 14 won't be on exam number 4. Okay, so it's going to be chapters 12 and 13, which is what? Muscle and blood, heart, and circulation. All right, so that's the deal for that exam coming up. Also, before the exam, the last day to drop, I think I can drop people on Sunday, but I'm not sure when the last day to drop for you is. It might be that Friday, it might be that Saturday, I'm not sure, or it might be Sunday. All right, if you want me to calculate your grades, I'll be happy to do that. And I'm inputting all your grades into Blackboard from your lab instructors. Yeah, I see a question. So let's take a question.
Is chapter 14 going to be on exam 5?
Yeah, then we'll, sure, because it's a really cool chapter. So I'm going to cover chapter 14 and we'll put it on the last exam. Okay, yeah, so don't. It's not wasted time if you studied 14 already. It's a really good chapter. All right, so let's finish up. Any other good questions? Any other questions you're not sure about if they're good or not? Generally, they're pretty good questions. All right, so let's continue on with today's lecture. The sign-in sheet is going around. It's taking a very circuitous route today, so make sure you sign in. Make sure you don't forget to sign in. Okay, and there was a student, I don't want to mention any names, there was a student that wanted to see me before class. I didn't see you before class, so maybe right after class you can see me to go over your grades. And I don't see you here, so maybe you're parking. All right, so let's go project like this. Schedule disappears. All right, so we're talking a lot about the blood, and two main processes of blood were agglutination and coagulation. They sound the same, but are they the same?
No,
totally different. What kind of reaction is coagulation?
Fibrin
formation is coagulation, and fibrin is that protein that makes a net that catches fluid and platelets and red blood cells that forms a blood clot. Okay, that's coagulation. Now, what is agglutination? What kind of reaction is agglutination? It's an antigen-antibody reaction, right? So you have an active site, you have a ligand that binds to it, and an antibody then will group together a whole bunch of red blood cells, causing clumping of red blood cells, but that's different than coagulation, right? That's an antibody-antigen reaction. Where are antigens located? On the membrane, on the cell membranes. Okay, so if somebody has blood type A, what does that mean? What does that really mean? They have the A antigen on the surface of those red blood cells, right? And then they also then automatically produce an antibody called B, anti-B. Right, they can't make anti-A because then their own red blood cells would agglutinate. Okay, so that's pretty good for those two processes. And remember that complicated chart of coagulation, once you look at it, it shouldn't be all too complicated. There are just three main processes. There's some ions that are necessary, like calcium. There's some lipids that are necessary for normal clotting function, like phospholipids. Those come from cell membranes when they get damaged. Let's see what else is necessary. Oh, you need a positive feedback mechanism to have normal blood clotting function. You should be aware of that. You should know what some compounds with a O-gen on the end of them, what that means. And if there's a prefix on some words like pro, what does that mean also? Okay, they're inactive precursors for something, but they can go to work in just a snap of your fingers to protect your body. And for coagulation, that would be from blood loss. All right, so we're going to switch our attention from blood to the cardiovascular system, mostly the heart in this chapter. And so I'll just ask you some quick questions to get you oriented. How many chambers does the heart have? And you should know right away. If you don't, you got to crack open your anatomy book, right? Four chambers. And you should know all of those chambers. How many valves does the heart have? Okay, that anatomy book is coming out, I can see, over the weekend, because there are four valves, right? Four chambers, four valves. And in particular, in terms of chambers, there are two superior chambers that we call atria, two inferior chambers that we call ventricles. Those are the mighty pumps that pump very strenuously. The atria hardly pump at all. Okay, and then the valves, you got to know. I probably should have told everybody to review valves before today's lecture. All right, there's a valve between atria and the ventricle. We call those atrioventricular valves. And then there are valves at the root of the great arteries coming off the base of the heart. There's an aortic semilunar valve and a pulmonary semilunar valve. And what's the job of those valves? Prevent what we call retrograde flow of blood, backward flow of blood. Wow, that projector is looking pretty weak over there. Maybe today it will burn out. That would be okay, because then we can get a new bulb. All right, so here is an atrioventricular valve. I'm showing you a picture on the screen right now. Here's an atrioventricular valve, and on this side of the heart is the tricuspid. Here's an atrioventricular valve on the left side of the heart. That is the bicuspid valve, because it has two cusps. And then here are the semilunar valves, aortic semilunar valve and pulmonary semilunar valve. Again, so you can see all four chambers, all four valves. Now, another question for you. How many sides does the heart have? It's got two. Yeah, it's got a left side, and it's got a right side. And we can see that the left side is filled with red-colored blood. The right side is filled with blue-colored blood. And that just signifies that the blue color is low, relatively low in oxygen, and the red color is relatively high in oxygen. So here's a vessel bringing blood back from the lungs, okay? And of course it's red color because there's exchange taking place in the lungs. There are capillaries, and oxygen in the alveoli of lungs enters the blood and it turns it red, and at the same time carbon dioxide is leaving. That's an excretory product. All right, so the two sides of the heart then supply blood to two circulations. You should also know what the circulations are. Two main circulations in your body are the pulmonary circulation, and the other is the systemic circulation. Remember, an artery, how would we define an artery? Takes blood away from the heart. So here we have a blood vessel that's taking blood away from the heart. Or is that an artery or a vein? I'm terribly confused because it's blue. Is this an artery or a vein? Because it's blue. What is it? It's an artery, right? Because an artery is only determined by the direction of blood flow, not what the quality of that blood is. Here is the pulmonary artery, because it's taking blood away from the heart, right? And it's blue because it's low in oxygen. It's going to the lungs to do what? To pick up oxygen, right? And then here is a blood vessel that's bringing blood back to the heart, and I'm confused once again because I think artery should be red, not, what is it? What kind of vessel is this right here? It's a vein because it's bringing blood back to the heart, but of course it's red because it's coming back from the lungs, right? It's highly oxygenated blood, so it's bright red. All right, so arteries and veins, you can't tell by the state of oxygenation, only the direction of blood flow. And in the pulmonary circulation, arteries are blue, veins are red. In the systemic circulation, arteries are red and veins are blue. They're what? Opposite each other. Okay. All right, so just remember, two sides of the heart, two different circulations. Don't forget about this fibrous skeleton. The fibrous skeleton of the heart lies on a plane between the atria and the ventricles. There are no muscle fibers in that region. Right? It's just connective tissue, and connective tissue does not conduct action potentials. It has very low electrical activity, very low electrical properties compared to muscle. Muscle acts like a nerve in what sense? What does a muscle cell have over the whole cell membrane? Voltage-gated channels, so muscle cells can transmit action potentials over the whole cell membrane. but connective tissue can't. So the atria are electrically isolated from the ventricles as a result of that. But that fibrous skeleton also is a very nice strong platform that all of the valves are attached to so that the valves don't dilate. That's really important, because if a valve dilates because they're not in a very strong platform, then the valve leaflets won't touch each other and they won't be able to close. They'll just flop back and forth. So that's another important feature of that fibrous skeleton of the heart. Oh, and here I see the fibrous skeleton right here. It surrounds all of the valves. Okay, so I'm going to go back to this picture right here. Which circulation is larger or longer? Is it the systemic that's bigger or the pulmonary? Systemic circulation, right, has much longer blood vessels. So it takes a lot more energy to pump blood through the larger circulation compared to the smaller pulmonary circulation. And the motive force for moving blood through through a pipe or through a blood vessel, or the motive force for moving any kind of fluid from one location to another, is, and you can use diffusion as a model in your mind. How does diffusion work? By concentration gradient. And what's the concentration? In what direction is it going to flow? Diffusion will work from high concentration to low concentration. The same thing for flow of a fluid, whether it's a gas that's in the air when we get to respiratory system, or a liquid that's in your blood vessels. That fluid will flow from high pressure to low pressure. It can only flow in that direction and not backwards like that. Okay, so the heart produces high pressure, which forces blood all the way through the vascular system, and it ends up in this atrium right here. So what has a higher pressure, this atrium or this ventricle? The higher pressure is in the ventricle, the lowest pressure is in the atrium, and that ensures that blood is going to flow in that direction. Okay. All right, here is something that's not so intuitive, and I want to make a certain point of this. That's why I put it in green or whatever color that is. Right, the rate of flow through the systemic circulation that we see right here is going to be the same as the flow through the pulmonary circulation. Because why is that? I think I want to draw a little diagram on the board. We said that the heart has two pumps, right? It has two sides, a right side and a left side. And actually, there are two pumps. All right, let me see if I can figure this out. Here is part of a heart. Actually, where's a good eraser at? Here's a fancy eraser. Okay, so don't draw this out just yet, because I've only kind of figured this out in my mind. So we have the left side and the right side of the heart. Correct? And we're going to erase the right side of this heart. We got left ventricle that's going to pump blood through a capillary network right here. And what circulation is this that I'm drawing? That's systemic. And here are a bunch of capillaries. Anybody know what the physiologic significance of a capillary is? Exchange, that's right. Things can enter or leave the circulatory system only at a capillary, not in an artery, not in a vein. So here is an artery. Here's a vein. And then it goes back to the heart, right? Because a vein brings blood back to the heart. But in this particular case, we're only going to be talking about the right ventricle. So I'm going to erase. So here's the LV. Here is the RV. The RV pumps blood through another set of capillaries, which are what? Pulmonary capillaries. So this is the pulmonary circulation. And then that goes back to the heart, correct? Okay, just like that. Okay, so we have two pumps that are in series with each other. They come after each other. So what would happen if we put in, if we broke this blood vessel right here and we didn't allow blood to flow back to the heart because we blocked it right here? What would happen to the systemic circulation? It would stop as well, right? Okay, it couldn't proceed. All right, so the flow through the pulmonary circulation over a relatively short period of time, like maybe a couple minutes or whatever, has to equal the flow through the systemic circulation. Right? If that's not true, let's just say that the pulmonary pump right here, the right ventricle was pumping more blood than the left ventricle. Okay, so the left ventricle was getting weak. What would happen to blood? It would start to build up, okay, in the systemic circulation. And you'd have more blood building up, and then the right side of the heart would become damaged as well, right? So the circulation for the systemic has to equal the pulmonary circulation over a long period of time, or even a fairly short period of time, like on the order of minutes. You can't let blood build up anywhere else because then the other circulation, right, won't be pumping the correct amount of blood. That's not too obvious, so I wanted to say that. Okay, the resistance in the systemic circulation, because it's larger, is greater than the pulmonary circulation. All right, so the work done by the left ventricle in pumping to the systemic circulation is 5 to 7 times greater than the right side of the heart. All right, and what happens to a muscle when you exercise it compared to another muscle that you hardly exercise at all? It gets bigger and stronger. It hypertrophies. So if we look at the left ventricle on this diagram right here, we can see that indeed the wall thickness is a lot thicker on the left compared to the right because it has to work almost 7 times as strong. Not quite 10 times more than the right ventricle, but a lot harder, right? So that makes the left ventricle more muscular. It's about 3 to 4 times thicker compared to the right ventricle. But nonetheless, what can you tell me about the flow leaving the left ventricle compared to the blood flow leaving the right ventricle? Even though they're working to different degrees, the left ventricle is working harder, what can you tell me about the blood flow that's being pumped by them? It's the same, okay? And that's because the resistance of the systemic circuit is so much bigger because it's a longer tube. Okay, heart valves. You know that there's 4 right now. You got 2 atrioventricular valves, 2 semilunar valves. Ooh, I'm missing the aortic semilunar valve on this diagram right here, but you should know where it is. And make sure you know what their names are. And these valves work passively. There's no muscles that open or close these valves. They open and close based on pressure differences. So when there's high pressure in the atrium compared to the ventricle, blood will flow from atria to ventricle. Remember, blood will flow down a pressure gradient. So when there's high pressure in an atrium, blood will flow into the ventricle. This valve opens up because these leaflets are very compliant. They'll just open right up. But when pressure in the ventricle exceeds the atria right here, there's pressure building up on this side of the valve, and it pushes it up in this direction, and it closes. So this atrioventricular valve closes when there's high pressure in the ventricle and low pressure in the atrium, right? And if it doesn't close, since there's high pressure in the ventricle and low pressure in the atrium, if the valve doesn't close, then blood will flow in the reverse direction or retrograde direction. And that eventually will kill the heart if that were allowed to continue. Okay, because the heart is working, expending ATP, and if it pumps blood, if the atria pumps blood into the ventricle and then it goes back to where it was, that's just a futile contraction that's using up energy for no good purpose, right? And that's going to damage the heart. Think of that as maybe running up a sand dune. Has anybody ever walked up or run up a sand dunes? Probably you never even thought of running up a sand dunes. But maybe walking, what's it like? Piece of cake or is it hard? It's really hard. Why is that? Because you take a step up and you go, oh, right, I took a step up. And just as you're celebrating, you took a step up, what's happening to you? You're sliding back down, right? And then you take another step up and you go, all right, I'm making progress. But what's happening? Then you start sliding back down again, right? So think of a heart with an insufficient valve that's not closing. That heart has to walk up that sand dune 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It just gets tired and it fails as a result. Just like you would fail and die if you had to walk up a sand dune for the rest of your life, right? It's just too hard. Okay, know these different structures, the papillary muscles and the chorda tendineae that prevent inversion of the leaflets of the atrioventricular valves. All right, semilunar valves don't have papillary muscles. It's just by their structure that they close when there is high pressure in a great artery. So when there is high pressure in the pulmonary artery, blood starts to flow back into a ventricle, in this particular case, the right ventricle, that will catch the underside of these leaflets right here and cause them to touch each other, and then that closes off the orifice or the opening to the pulmonary artery. When there's high pressure in a ventricle, it pushes blood into the artery, these valves open up. When blood starts to flow backwards, then they close as a result. That's just a passive process. Cardiac cycle. Okay, we haven't talked about this. So this is some new information. I don't think we've talked about this. I typically don't talk about this very much in anatomy. Maybe you haven't. So this is nice new information for you. The cardiac, or the heart, is a pump. It's pressurizing blood so that it's going to flow from high pressure to low pressure. But it's not like a pump that you have at home that you can just plug into an electrical socket that is pumping all the time. There is a time when the heart is pumping, and that's when it's when the muscle's contracting, and then there's another part of the time where the heart is relaxing, right? Where it's not actually pumping blood. Right? There's no blood flowing out of the heart when it is relaxing, but there's something good that is happening during relaxation. In order for the heart to pump blood when it contracts, guess what has to be in the heart? Blood has to be in there, right? So during that period of time when the heart is not contracting, it is filling up with blood. And that's just as important as the period of time when the heart is contracting, pumping blood out. Both of those phases have to be operating properly in a heart to be normal, right? The phase that the heart is in when it's contracting is called systole, and the phase that the heart is in when it's relaxing is called diastole. Right, so these are the two main phases right here. So when the heart pumps during systole, we have very high pressure, right? Then the heart starts to relax, that pressure starts to die back down, and it's going to die down and die down, get lower, 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 and then all of a sudden the pressure starts to increase again when what happens? When the heart contracts. Okay, so the pressure increases when the heart contracts during systole, pressure decreases when the heart is relaxing during systole. And when you measure somebody's blood pressure, that's why we always are given two numbers, at least in Western medicine. Okay, and those two numbers refer to the peak pressure that's in a blood vessel that's right after the heart contracts. And then the second number is right before the heart contracts again, that's the lowest blood pressure. And that number is measured once again. So we call it a systolic pressure and a diastolic pressure. And so the two numbers typically normally right here are 120 millimeters of mercury over 80. That's a systolic pressure over the diastolic pressure. And that's probably a pretty good number, unless you're getting up into your 60s or 70s or something. It can creep up a little bit. But everybody's blood pressure should be about that level. All right, and we can measure that blood pressure, for instance, in your brachial artery. That's an easy way to do it with a sphygmomanometer, right, and a stethoscope. And what circulation are we measuring that pressure in? Yeah, remember there's two circulations, systemic and pulmonary. So when we report this number right here, measure it in a brachial artery, that is systemic pressure only, right? That has no indication of what the pulmonary pressure is. Now, somebody can experience below normal blood pressure, or they can experience above normal blood pressure. What do we call above normal? Hypertension. All right, and you should all know that the very prevalent disease process kills many people, okay, in the United States and other places of the world. I should Google that and find out how many people die of hypertension every year. I don't know. I could say millions, but I'm just making that up. But I might not be wrong. All right, so that's a very prevalent disease process. So when you get your blood pressure measured, that one measurement probably saves more lives than anything else, as long as a person elects to do something about it. All right? So you might have a family member that has hypertension, and you just really have to help them out to control that condition. Or if you have that condition and you're not paying attention to it, then of course you really should, because it produces a lot of heart disease and vascular disease and strokes and kidney disease, and it affects every organ system in your body. So we're going to spend a lot of time with hypertension. And does anybody know why it's hard to maintain compliance when you're treating hypertension for most people? Because when you have high blood pressure, you feel fantastic. You feel great. But as soon as you start taking some medication to bring your blood pressure down from a pathological level to normal, that's when you feel lousy. You feel lethargic, typically. All right, so people just kind of give up taking care of themselves, and that's really bad when that happens. Okay, so you've got to help your family members take their medication, and it might even take a year for a patient to work with a physician to get the right kinds of mixture of medications to control their blood pressure while still feeling pretty normal, right? So it's not a process where you just walk in and then walk out of the doctor's office feeling fantastic. Yeah. Ah, okay. So I'm talking about, so we just got done talking about hypertension, which is high blood pressure. What happens with the other end when you call it hypotensive? Hypo means below normal blood pressure, all right? Well, you know what? Hypotension is not clinically a problem, all right, unless your blood pressure is so low so that when you stand up, you lose consciousness, you pass out, okay? We realize now, I think I'm speaking from theory, not just hypothesis, but the lower your blood pressure is, the more protected from cardiovascular disease you are. So the lower this number is, the better for you, as long as what? You don't experience syncope or fainting spells, okay? So if you have low blood pressure, that does not necessarily mean that you will feel fatigued, okay? You can still feel and function just fine with low blood pressure. And you should actually feel very grateful that you have low blood pressure, because chances are you're at very low risk for any other form of cardiovascular disease. Okay? So if you have hypotension, oh, I congratulate you. That's great. Yeah, question.
I have low blood pressure. Uh-huh. And I asked the doctor, what do I do? Is
yeah.
Problem?
Yeah.
Don't take a shot.
A shot. A shot of what? Like tequila or whiskey? I want to know that trick. That sounds like or maybe a Cabernet. I'm not sure what she means. Like an injection of something?
No, she told me it's like a shot of tequila.
Oh, a shot of tequila.
Yeah.
I think that's an interesting hypothesis, but I don't think that's a theory. I don't think that's been proven in any kind of formal scientific study that will help. Okay. So I don't know. I can't really relate to that too much. Okay? I don't know what to say about that. So, yeah. Okay. So I'm not sure where that is coming from. But there are many branches of medicine, and maybe that comes from something I'm just not aware of. Okay. Now notice this pulmonary circulation right here. We said what? That the pulmonary circulation is a lot shorter, doesn't require the same amount of energy to get the blood flowing through it, and so the pressure is a lot less. It's only 25 millimeters of mercury over 10 millimeters of mercury, the diastolic right here. All right, has anybody ever measured their pulmonary blood pressure? No, because where do you have to go to measure that pressure? You got to dig deep inside your thoracic cavity to find it, right? So typically it is never measured, but people do have pulmonary hypertension, right? And when somebody has pulmonary hypertension, so it's high blood pressure in the pulmonary circulation, which means that the right ventricle has to pump a lot harder to get blood through the pulmonary circulation, and the right side of the heart can fail as a result of that. So it doesn't mean that it's not a serious condition, it just means that there's no easy way to measure it in people. But it can be a serious problem, and maybe we'll talk about why it develops every once in a while. So just remember, pulmonary hypertension we're going to talk about later on in the class. Okay, cardiac cycle has got some important landmarks that we have to understand. And there is a volume inside a ventricle that we call the end diastolic volume. And what does diastole mean once again? It's the period of time of relaxation. What's happening to the heart when it's relaxed? Is it staying the same shape? Is it shrinking? Or is it enlarging? Since it's not contracting, it's filling up with blood, so it is expanding. Right? So end diastolic volume is the volume of blood in the ventricles at the end of diastole. And systolic volume, let's skip one for a second. And systolic volume is the amount of blood left in the ventricles at the end of systole. And what's systole again? Contraction. And so what's the volume of the ventricle at the end of systole? Is it large or small?
Small.
It's going to be small because that's when contraction takes place. All right, and then here's another term called stroke volume. That's the amount of blood ejected from the ventricles during systole. So if we subtract these two volumes from each other, then we get the amount that is pumped out of the heart every time it contracts. So for every beat, that's the amount of volume of blood that gets pumped out. So how would we do that to subtract these two numbers? What do we subtract from each other? Which is the bigger number once again? Because we're talking about a volume of the ventricle. When is the ventricle the largest? Diastole. So it's a little tricky, but once you think of it, you see that. So how would we find out how much blood leaves the heart? You take the big number, subtract the smaller number from it, and that's the stroke volume. So the big number is what? End diastolic volume. We subtract end systolic volume of the ventricle, and that tells us how much blood was pumped during that particular beat, which is what? The stroke volume. Okay, so here's a little, break your calculator out, you can do that. What's the stroke volume if the ESV is 20 mLs and the EDV is 80 mLs? You probably don't need your calculator. I won't even tell you the correct answer. Okay. All right, so as the ventricles contract, as the muscles contract, think of you have a balloon in your hands and you contract the muscles of your hand. What happens to pressure inside that balloon? Do you have an intuitive sense that the pressure inside that balloon is going to increase? Right? Same thing with the heart. As the ventricle contracts, the pressure rises in the ventricles. Blood is going to want to flow from a ventricle back up into an atrium. Okay, but in the normal heart, can it do that? Can blood flow from a ventricle back into an atrium in a normal heart? No, because there's an AV valve that's going to prevent that from happening, right? Okay, so the AV valve closes, and at this particular time, the semilunar valves are closed as well. So all the valves to the left ventricle or to any ventricle are closed. If all the valves to a ventricle are closed, then the volume of that ventricle can't change, but the ventricle is still going to contract. All right, so it's going to contract, it's going to produce more tension. The volume doesn't change, but as the ventricle contracts, the pressure increases in the ventricle. We call that isovolumetric contraction. When all the valves to the heart are closed, the ventricles are contracting, but the volume can't change, so we say isovolumetric. Iso means what? Staying the same. All right, then when pressure in the ventricles exceed that in the pulmonary artery or the aorta, then the semilunar valves open. And then blood is ejected from the ventricle into the aorta. Let's just talk about the left side of the heart. All right, so then the heart ejects blood, and then the heart starts to go back into diastole, right? And as the ventricle pressure falls below that in the aorta, right? So now we have high pressure in the aorta, low pressure in the ventricles, which way is blood going to flow? If it's high pressure in the aorta, low in the ventricles, which way does blood want to flow? From high to low, so it's going to want to flow back in the ventricles. That should not happen, and indeed that does not happen in a normal heart because then you have the semilunar valves closing at that time. Okay. And now, okay, all of the valves, again, are closed, and the volume of the ventricle can't change. It is still relaxing, so the tension is decreasing. The pressure in the ventricle is decreasing. We call that isovolumetric relaxation. So we have two isovolumetric phases. We have isovolumetric contraction, isovolumetric relaxation. These periods of isovolumetric existence happen when all of the valves to a ventricle are closed, both AV valves and both semilunar valves. Okay. But when pressure in the ventricles falls below the atria, then the atria can pump blood into the ventricles, so the AV valves open, right? And the ventricles start to fill up with blood again. And then the atria go into contraction and even pump a little bit more blood. So here is a pretty good diagram. I think this is not the exam figure. The exam figure that covers this topic right here is the one that's in your lab manual, which is really nice. I like it. This is called the Wiggers diagram, and all of them have errors here and there. This one has very few errors. I just don't like the presentation of it very much. I like the one that's in your lab manual. And I've modified it a little bit in your study guide. And so there's a key in your study guide, and I changed the answers around a little bit. So make sure you look at the key that's in your exam study guide and that Wiggers diagram. But this is good for lecture instructional purposes. So let's go over this. On this diagram right here, we see a number of physiologic parameters on the y-axis, and it's plotted out versus time on the x-axis right here. So these are all some things that are plotted versus time. And what are some of these things? We see some electrical events versus time. So if we put electrodes on the surface of somebody, we can measure the electrical properties of the heart, and we call that the electrocardiogram. Okay? An electrocardiograph is the instrument that makes the gram. All right? Just like the telegraph is the instrument that makes the telegram. Now you know how old I am. Okay. All right, so electrocardiogram, sometimes it's spelled with a C, sometimes with a K. K is just a more, little bit more archaic, but it's a more European way of spelling it. But it means exactly the same thing. And in a hospital, you might see signs telling you in a hallway to go to get an ECG, and sometimes it's going to be spelled with a C and sometimes with a K, right? So it doesn't matter one way or the other. All right, so here is a plot of the electrical activity of the heart versus time. Here is a plot of volume of a ventricle, the volume versus time. All right, and how do we measure volume? Milliliters is a good measure of volume, right? Okay, and here we have pressures versus time. And all these plots are justified exactly so that they line up perfectly in time so we can compare what's happening in the heart at a particular time. We can look at pressure, we can look at volume, we can look at electrical activity, and we can even look at the, this is kind of funny saying it this way, we can look at the heart sounds, all right, but we're not looking at them, right, on this graph we're looking at them, but otherwise we would be doing what to them? Listening to them, right? Okay, so these are heart sounds, and these normal heart sounds are due to closing of valves, and I'm only going to talk about the first two, right? In the abnormal heart, we will have other sounds that are taking place which represent abnormal events that are taking place in the heart. We'll talk about that in just a little bit. Okay, so let's start talking about some pressure events. So let's look at pressure versus time. And I see three different curves right here in maybe three different colors. It looks like two different colors to me. All right, I see something blue. And this blue right here represents the pressure in a ventricle. And are we looking at one in particular? No, we could say left. Let's just say left ventricle, okay? And what does the pressure vary between in the left ventricle? What are the extremes? What's the high number? It looks like 120, what, millimeters of mercury, okay? What's the low value for pressure inside of a ventricle? Look at this right here. What's this number? What's this number right here? Zero, yes, okay? So you got to be able to read these graphs right here. So the pressure in a ventricle changes from 0 to 120. Okay, what phase do you think the heart is in when it's 0? Diastole. Yeah, good. Use that term, diastole. And when the pressure is 120, what phase of the heart is that? Systole, right? During contraction. And indeed, that's what we see right here. So we see systole between this big line here and this big line right here that represents contraction, and then diastole is occurring during this period of time, and we can see very low pressure and even zero pressure in the ventricles. Which phase of the heart cycle is longer, systole or diastole? Diastole, yeah, it takes longer for the heart to fill than it does to contract, and that's probably a pretty good thing. All right, so when the heart starts to contract, or when the ventricle starts to contract, okay, here's an AV valve, and at this period of time, there's higher pressure in an atrium. This line right here represents atrial blood pressure. I'm not going to say what color it is, but that's atrial blood pressure right there. Is higher than ventricular blood pressure. So which way is blood going to flow in this at this particular time? High pressure to low pressure, so blood is going to flow from an atrium into the ventricle, and indeed it does. And I can actually see the volume is what? Increasing in the ventricle, because this is a ventricular volume curve. So the ventricular volume increases because blood is flowing from atria to ventricles at this location. All right. But now the ventricle starts to contract. And as it's contracting, what happens to pressure? Can you see we have pressure right here? It increases, and now it is higher than the atria. And so which way does blood want to flow now? Back into the atrium, Okay, but it can't, because what happens right at this point in time when the pressure is higher in the ventricle compared to the atria? The AV valve closes. So this first heart sound is due to closure of the AV valves, atrioventricular valves. And you know their names, right? Tricuspid and bicuspid. What's on the right side of the heart? The tricuspid. Remember, try before you buy. Okay, so here we have AV valve close. As you look at it in a diagram from right to left, right? Okay. So here, the AV valve closes, but also at this period of time, the semilunar valves are closed, so blood can't leave the ventricle because all the valves are closed. The ventricles are still contracting, but blood can't leave, so the volume is the same, but the pressure increases. We call this what? Isovolumetric contraction. All right, so here is the pressure in the aorta. Let's look at this for a second. What's the highest pressure in the aorta? 120. What's the lowest pressure? 80. What did we say normal blood pressure was? 120 over 80, right? Because we measure nice systemic arterial blood pressure. So we're looking at the, I guess, left side of the heart, not the right side of the heart. All right, so the pressure in the aorta is about 120. When the pressure in the ventricles exceeds 80 millimeters of mercury or is higher than the pressure in the aorta, what happens at this period of time? Can blood flow from a ventricle into an aorta? It can, as long as the aortic valve opens up. If the aortic valve opens up, blood can flow from a ventricle into the aorta, and indeed, that's what happens right here. And as blood flows from the ventricle into the aorta, look at the pressure of the aorta. What does it do? It starts to increase, okay? Because blood is being ejected from the ventricle, right? The AV valve is closed, but the semilunar valve is open. Blood flows into the aorta. We call that the ejection phase of systole. Okay, and then since blood is leaving the heart, even though the heart is still contracting, it can't maintain that high pressure because there's no volume of blood in the ventricle. So the pressure of ventricular blood starts to decline. It goes down, goes down, goes down. All right, and right at this period of time right here, okay, this is where the diagram is a little bit wrong. On the diagram right here, now we have high pressure in the aorta, low pressure in the ventricle. Which way will blood want to flow? Okay, back from the aorta into the ventricle. But now, can that happen in a normal heart? Because right at this period of time, the aortic valve closes. So if I was going to draw this diagram, I'd actually draw this blue line up over to here, so it crosses over right here. Okay. So right when the pressure in the aorta exceeds the ventricle, the aortic valve closes, and the blood has to flow backwards just transiently to close those valves, and that produces this little notch in the aortic pressure or systemic blood pressure. That's what we call the dicrotic notch. That's exactly when the semilunar valve closes, right here. All right, so now the semilunar valve closes, the AV valve is closed, so the volume of the ventricle can't change. But what about pressure during this period of time? It still decreases, but the volume stays the same, so we call this isovolumetric relaxation. Again, that happens when all the valves are closed. Okay, and right at this period of time, this is accurate on this diagram. Now, the pressure in the ventricle is below the pressure of the atrium. So here's atrial pressure. Atrial pressure is higher than ventricular pressure. Which way does blood flow now? Into the ventricle. So the AV valve opens right at this point in time. And indeed, if we look at the volume of the ventricle down on this graph right here, we can see that once this AV valve opens, what happens now? The ventricles start to fill with blood. They start to get larger and larger and larger. Okay, and then this right here signifies a little bit of contraction of the atria that pumps a little bit more blood into the ventricles from the atria when that happens. Okay, so on this graph right here, here we have volume. On the previous slide, you learned of something called end diastolic volume and end systolic volume. Let's label it on this diagram right here. What volume is this? Right where I have the cursor. Can you see the cursor? Okay, what are your two choices? What are the two choices? End diastolic and end systolic volume. Which one is this? This is end diastolic volume because the ventricle is relaxed during this period of time. It's filling up with blood. And this is 130 mLs typically on a heart. This is the large volume. End diastolic volume is a large volume. And then when the ventricle contracts, it ejects blood from the ventricle, right? And this is then the end systolic volume. Could you calculate the stroke volume for this particular heart from this graph? Indeed you could, because you could subtract this volume from this one right here, and you'd end up with a number which would be what? Like what? What is that? Like 80 mLs. Okay? That would be the stroke volume. Okay, so when the AV valve, I tell you what, when the semilunar valve closes right here, that produces the second heart sound. When the AV valve closes right at this location, that produces the first heart sound. So the first heart sound happens at the beginning of systole. The second heart sound happens at the end of systole, or you could say the beginning of diastole. I wouldn't care too much one way or the other. All right, one last graph I want to look at is this ECG right here. ECG just measures the electrical properties of the heart on the surface of the human body using electrodes. And I think you did this in lab. Did you do it? Are you going to do it? Have you done this yet?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. Did you use subcutaneous electrodes or surface electrodes? Did anybody volunteer for the needles underneath the skin? You did? Okay. So that gives you a really pretty ECG, but you don't necessarily have to do that. You can just put electrodes right on the surface of your skin. So here's the first wave. Here's the second wave. Here's the third wave. And you should know the names of these different waves. And they represent depolarization, at least some of them do. This first one right here is depolarization of the atria. It produces this wave. That's the primavera wave. What does that mean? That's the first wave. Yeah, or P wave. Okay, this one right here. That's depolarization of the atria. Depolarization is not synonymous with contraction. Depolarization is just an electrical event, which then leads to contraction via what? Excitation contraction that we talked about, right? So these electrical events precede what we can see as a physical event inside the heart, physical contraction. So this P wave precedes atrial contraction. And then there's a little bit of a delay, fairly large delay. This depolarization happens only in the atria, but it takes time for that depolarization to enter the ventricles. Then the ventricles depolarize during this period of time, and it's a much bigger wave because what's the amount of muscle tissue in the ventricles compared to the atria? A lot more. So it produces a lot more electrical activity. We call this the QRS complex. It represents ventricular depolarization, but also during this period of time, we see repolarization of the atria. It's a very tiny signal, and we can't see it within the large QRS complex from the ventricles. Right? So think of if it was a nice clear day outside today, the sun would be out, nice. And if you walked outside, could you see any other stars in the sky? Are they still there, or do they disappear? They're still there. Can you see them? No, but you're trying to convince me they're still there. Why can't you see them if they're there but you can't see them? Because the sun is too bright, right? So if we were to turn the sun down, then of course the stars would appear. The same thing with this QRS complex. We can't see the electrical signal from repolarization because the depolarization from the ventricle is just too big. If we could get rid of the depolarization from the ventricles, then we could see repolarization from the atria. All right, and then there's another period of quiet right here, and the last wave, this is the T wave. T wave represents repolarization of the ventricles. All right, the other thing that you notice on this slide is here is peak depolarization of the ventricles, but where is peak contraction of the ventricles? At the same time? No, contraction follows depolarization. All right, and as a matter of fact, when you think of depolarization and repolarization, does one always come before the other? Yeah, depolarization always happens before repolarization, right? And depolarization is excitation of that particular tissue. All right, so take a look at this nice Wiggers diagram that you have in your lab book and work on that exam figure that you have. Okay, heart sounds, we talked about them already. Closing of the AV valve at the beginning of systole is the first heart sound. And then at the end of systole, the semilunar valve closes, and we call that the second heart sound. All right, so only when heart valves close do we hear them. I can't hear yours without a stethoscope. I'm too far away. But they actually produce quite a racket in there because there's high pressures that are just slamming those valves closed. Okay, if those valves aren't operating properly, they can produce murmurs, additional kinds of sounds. All right, so a heart murmur is produced by the heart that's not functioning properly. It could be due to holes in the heart or valves that aren't working. All right, and we would like to know exactly what's producing those sounds. All right, so murmurs are due to abnormal patterns of blood flow in the heart. They could be due to defective heart valves. They may be congenital in origin. Maybe during development, during gestation, the valves don't develop properly. Okay, and then they're going to make funny squeaking sounds or swishing sounds that you can hear with a stethoscope. All right, or they might be developmental. Developmental means that at the condition that develops after somebody's born, as in the case of rheumatic fever. If somebody gets rheumatic fever, okay, there's a bacteria that produces that, and that's a streptococcus infection. And of course, your body produces antibodies to fight that infection because it produces antibodies that bind to antigens on that streptococcus bacteria. Unfortunately, the antigens on the streptococcus are very similar to the antigens that are on the surface of the cells that make valves in your heart. So when your body produces antibodies against the streptococcus bacteria, it's also making antibodies against what? Your heart, the valves that make your heart. And then those antibodies destroy the valves of the heart. We call that rheumatic fever. Now that sounds really unfair. And you're right, it is. That shouldn't happen. It does happen. That's an autoimmune disease. And then we have to treat that person. Maybe that valve can be repaired. Maybe it has to be replaced, depending on how bad the damage is. Okay. There's a form of streptococcus called mutans and also lactobacilli that cause dental caries. They live in our oral cavity underneath plaques in particular. Okay. And they secrete acid, and that acid then dissolves our teeth away as a result of that, and that produces a dental cavity or a dental carie. Somebody had a fantastic idea. Well, since these bacteria produce dental disease, cavities, how about if we give them an immunization against these bacteria and we can wipe out dental cavities just by giving somebody a shot? That's a really fantastic idea. Okay, so they developed a vaccine and they tested it in animal models, maybe rats or mice or maybe even went as far as monkeys. And then they found that when somebody got an immunization and that person developed antibodies against these bacteria that produce dental cavities, those antibodies also attack the heart of that particular animal. Okay, so you can protect yourself from dental cavities, never ever have them, by getting an immunization, but you also have to agree to live without what else in your body? Your heart. That no one has agreed to, right? So FDA has never approved, of course, that kind of vaccine because of what? Cross-matching of those antibodies to the bacteria and the antigens that are on the surface of the heart. Okay. So hopefully somebody's working on maybe another kind of antigen. That would be great, not to have dental cavities. Okay. Oh, when you have dental work, sure, because your mouth is a very active place. It's not a sterile environment, for instance. And somebody just mentioned sometimes you do have to take antibiotics before you have certain kinds of dental procedures, okay, just to help protect, okay, the rest of your body because you don't want those bacteria getting into your bloodstream and even infecting parts of your heart. Okay, a little bit different kind of thing. Okay, mitral stenosis. Stenosis is when a valve doesn't open up, right? It has a tendency to stay closed. So if it's closed, when an atria contracts, it's not going to pump blood into the ventricle, right? So that's a stenotic valve, and it makes a funny sound as well, okay? That's not good. So that allows for accumulation of blood in the left ventricle, and that can cause pulmonary hypertension, which is going to cause the right side of the heart to die. None of those things are very good. But when blood accumulates any place in your body, including the left atrium, what happens to blood if it stops flowing? Maybe I mentioned this last time in lecture, maybe not. Blood will stay a nice fluid if it's in motion. But if it becomes stationary, then it likes to change from a fluid to a solid. What is that process called? Coagulation. It coagulates, and then in an atrium you have a coagulated blood mass in your heart, which is terrible, right? Because it might move from an atrium into another part of your body, like a lung, and cause a pulmonary embolism or a stroke in your brain or heart attack if it gets into your heart. Okay, so that is important. We want blood flowing through the atria very nice and smoothly at all times, if at all possible. Sometimes maybe you can't stop it from happening. All right, valves are what we call incompetent or insufficient if they don't close properly. So valves might not open. We call that a stenotic valve, or they might not close. And in that case, we call that an incompetent or an insufficient valve. And that could be due to the valve leaflets, or it could be due to the papillary muscles, or other kinds of pathologies. We don't have time to talk about all the fun ways that we could treat somebody with that kind of condition. But you have a number of choices. I'll talk about it just really quickly. You have a number of choices if you have an incompetent valve. Maybe it's a minor defect, and it can be repaired with surgery. That would be the best choice, right? But if the damage is so bad, then it has to be replaced. What would be, anybody know what your choices are if you need to get a replacement heart valve? You can get an artificial valve made out of metal and plastic and things like that. Those are fantastic because your body won't reject them because they're not made out of living tissue. All right, but they're big, hard structures. And when you put that big, hard structure in a blood vessel, it's going to have a tendency to form clots. So if you have an artificial valve, then you need something called a blood thinner, right? Something that reduces clotting function. But do these things really thin your blood? No, they just disturb the normal clotting function that you looked at, right? That cascade of mechanisms. It has nothing to do with blood thinning. But when we talk to the public, that's an easy way to kind of understand without doing what I tried to do with my nephews when they were 2 and 3 years old, right? The intrinsic pathway, extrinsic pathway, that kind of thing, right? We just say blood thinning, and then people go on from there. Okay, so prosthetic valve is kind of safe because you can't reject it, but then you need to be on anticoagulation therapy for the rest of your life. You might not like that. So let's go to the next best choice, maybe a pig heart or a pig valve, okay? And pig valve is really nice because you can't get infected. You can't get AIDS or hepatitis from a pig valve, all right? But your body still might reject that particular valve. So they're really handy. They don't produce blood clots quite so much. They don't need to be on anticoagulation therapy, but you have to be on immunosuppressants maybe for the rest of your life, all right? And maybe you have something against pigs and you don't like artificial valves, so another choice would be from a cadaver, a human cadaver, right? Maybe it matches up really nice with your heart. All right, but then if you get a cadaver valve, that's a human valve, what are you worried about? Okay, maybe it wasn't checked properly in the lab for HIV and hepatitis, and maybe you could get an infection like that from that cadaver. All right, and then of course, then your body is going to reject it as well. So you have to be on anti-rejection medication. So there are different things that you have to weigh to see what's best for you. Okay, and they last different periods of time, right? That might weigh into your decision. So if you're 95 years old, then you probably don't care how long the valve is going to last, right? But if you're 45, then you probably want to go with a valve that's going to last as long as possible because you don't want to have open heart surgery, which I understand.
When you have a heart murmur,
I think sometimes the mitral valve can make noise and other times it can't, especially if it's stenotic or if it's prolapsed, if it bends back a little bit. And if it's a prolapse, it can be clinically unimportant. Okay? So if somebody can have a murmur in the heart due to mitral valve prolapse, and sometimes it's clinically relevant because it might hurt cardiac function, and other times it's so minor that it really has no cardiac significance. Of all the other kinds of heart valve problems typically are clinically significant that you have to deal with at some point in time. Yeah. So it all depends on what kind of murmur it is. Right. And that's usually due to prolapse, which is even a different case than stenosis or incompetency right here. Okay. Other kinds of murmurs in the heart. Okay. You all know that when we were a fetus, there was a hole. What do we call a hole in anatomy? A foramen, right? There was a hole in the interatrial septum that allowed blood to flow from the right atrium directly into the left atrium. And when it does, it bypasses the pulmonary circulation, or bypasses what organ? It bypasses the lungs, because when you're in utero, you don't need to breathe because there's no air in the uterus to breathe anyway, right? All right, so what's the name of the organ where a fetus is getting oxygen? It's not the lungs, it is the? Yeah, it's the placenta, right? So it's a lot of wasted energy to pump blood through the lungs when you're a fetus. So here is a foramen between the right atrium and left atrium. We call that the foramen ovale. Okay. And then when you're born, that should close over. And if it doesn't close over, right, it remains a patent foramen ovale. And guess how we talk about that? What's a patent foramen ovale? I have it here in bold. That's a PFO. Okay, patent foramen ovale. Patent just means that it's a tube that is acting like a tube so stuff can actually flow through it. If it's no longer patent, then that tube is closed. Right? So if this foramen ovale closes, it's no longer patent. But if that doesn't happen in everybody, okay, so if you're born and you have this big hole remains in the heart, then you're not sending blood to the lungs. You're breathing, but blood isn't going there to pick up oxygen. What color is your body going to be? Yeah, we don't really say blue. We say cyanotic, right? So as soon as somebody's born, that's one of the first things that people look at is the color of somebody's skin, right? And it goes into a score. Anybody know what that score is? Okay, that's like their first board exam right there, as soon as you're born. That's called an Apgar score. And they look at color and they say, oh, okay, do you have the proper color for your particular parents, right? And if you're blue, that could signify a heart defect, right, which could be really serious. Okay, so that's what we call a septal defect in the interatrial septum. But there could also be a hole in the ventricle right here. It's a little bit more serious condition, right? So blood is going to squirt from the left ventricle into the right ventricle and produce quite a racket. All right, that's really easy to pick up with a stethoscope. And, of course, that has to be repaired right away. So how do you know where this hole is that's making a racket? You can do an ultrasound, but probably the best thing is an MRI exam. Okay, it's really easy to see with an MRI exam. And I see blood flowing from the left ventricle into the right ventricle. This would be a really good board question. Okay, it always happens that way. Blood always flows from the left ventricle into the right ventricle when somebody has an interventricular septal defect, and you should be able to tell me why that is always the case. Because what ventricle produces a higher pressure? The left produces a higher pressure, and how does fluid flow? Always from high pressure to low pressure, right? So you always visualize the defect within the right ventricle when that happens. Okay. Oh, here's the question. Maybe I made that slide at one point in time. Okay, electrical activity of the heart. In anatomy, we talked about really fancy techniques to fix some of those holes in the heart. Don't have time to talk about them in physiology, but you can see me during office hours. All right, electrical activity of the heart. Myocardial cells are short, remember, and they're branched, and they have electrical synapses between them. What's the physical structure in the intercalated disc that allows that intercalated disc to be an electrical synapse as opposed to a chemical synapse? Yeah, gap junction, right? So sodium can actually diffuse down a concentration gradient from one cell to another through those gap junctions. And when sodium enters the cell, what is that electrically? What kind of electrical event is that? Yeah, it's excitation because it's depolarization, right? Okay. All right, so the entire heart that forms a chamber, we call that the myocardium, and in particular a functional syncytium, because as long as one muscle cell becomes depolarized or excited, what happens to the whole heart? Because there are gap junctions between all the cells of the heart. They all depolarize, right? And then that depolarization is the signal for contraction, so then the heart contracts as a unit. All right, so all action potentials originating in any cell are transmitted to all others. All right, now we did see that the atria and ventricles are electrically isolated from each other because of that fibrous skeleton. All right, so that's a problem or an issue that we have to deal with, or that the heart has to deal with. Okay. So here are the, what we call the nodal cells of the heart. And we see them in yellow right here. These are myocytes. These are muscle cells, but they don't contract very much. They're more specialized for conducting electrical information. They depolarize, right? So they're acting more like an axon than a muscle cell because they don't contract very much. But remember, muscles and axons are very similar. What is the membrane protein that they share in common with each other? The voltage-gated sodium channels, right? So as soon as they depolarize, more sodium channels open. That's the basis of that action potential. So action potentials can flow over every cell inside the heart, and especially over these nodal cells. All right, so let's look at nodal cells first. Here is the SA node, right at the junction of the superior vena cava and the wall, free wall of the right atrium. These cells are autorhythmic. That means that they spontaneously depolarize all by themselves. Right? And when they depolarize to threshold, then that produces an action potential, which then can flow over the whole cell. And all myocardial cells are autorhythmic. It just so happens that those in the sinoatrial node have the highest rate of depolarization, the highest rhythm of depolarization. So it functions as a pacemaker because they depolarize the fastest, then as soon as they depolarize, that causes depolarization of the whole heart. All right, so that's why we call that the pacemaker of the heart. It controls the whole heart rhythm. Let's see what other slides I have. Okay, so depolarization is going to emanate from the SA node, and then it can't get into the ventricles because you have the fibrous skeleton right here, but here is a modification to the heart. Here is the AV node. Depolarization reaches the AV node, and there it is delayed for a short period of time, and then the depolarization goes through the AV bundle, and the AV bundle pierces the fibrous skeleton of the heart and takes that depolarization into the ventricles. All right, so that's how electrical excitation gets into the ventricles. It goes through the fibrous skeleton right here at the atrioventricular bundle, or AV bundle. And then it bifurcates. We have two bundles right here that we call the bundle branches. Action potentials move very rapidly down through the interventricular septum to the apex of the heart through the bundle branches, right? And then the depolarization spreads from the apical regions of the heart back up to the basal regions of the heart. Remember, this is what? The base of the heart. Here's the apex of the heart. All right, so that just means that the apical regions of the heart contract first, or of the ventricles before the basal regions. And that's really a good thing. So let's look and see how this happens. The SA node causes both atria to contract, followed by contraction of both ventricles, because this AV node right here delays the signal into the ventricles. So both atria contract, and that's good because that helps load the ventricles with a little bit more blood so that when they contract, they pump more blood. And then the apical regions of the ventricles contract. Which way is that going to push blood when the apical region contracts? It's going to push it up, and where do you have the great arteries at? You don't have them down here in the apex. You have them up here by the base, and that helps eject blood out the aorta and pulmonary artery. If the basal regions were to contract first before the apical regions, which way would blood be pumped? Down into the apex, it would have nowhere to go, and it would be just a big mess, right? I'm just sort of kidding, but that would be really bad if that were to happen. Okay, so what spreads depolarization from the bundle branches to all the myocardium are what we call Purkinje fibers. These are these highly branched parts of nodal tissue. Oh, I said know that on your own. Well, I guess we went over that in anatomy. And I got to stop here, but here is a plot of electrical activity versus time of the nodal cells within the heart, not the contractile cells. We're going to look at action potentials from contractile cells later, but take a look at that figure. Wow, I got way too carried away. All right, sign and sheet, please. It's going around. Hey, Andrea, are you here anywhere? Okay, good. Oh, that's right. We have to talk about that. Okay, I haven't yet for anybody in the class, so I'm just kind of treating everybody the same. Okay. So I think maybe send me an email. I want to look at all your grades.
Okay.
Okay. And I want to see how it affects your grades. I don't want it to affect your grades really bad. So I want to see how it affects them.
Okay.
And I think I'm going to have maybe another extra credit lab quiz that can be used to replace a quiz that you have in lab or an online quiz. So then one of those zeros can go away. Okay. So tell me your name again.
Amanda.
Oh, yeah. Okay. So send me an email saying that we talked about the missing quizzes, online quiz, so online quiz in particular, and give me the CRN number of your section so I can find you fast in Blackboard. Okay. Hi.
I was going to remind you, you told me about dropping on Sunday.
Oh, yeah, when was that? Is it this Sunday or next Sunday? I think it's maybe next Sunday. Let's see, I have it here. May 6th. So that is not this weekend. It's next weekend. May 6th might be a Friday. Saturday, yeah. Will I drop you?
Oh, no, you said you wouldn't.
Okay, so are you talking about dropping the class? Are you concerned about dropping the class?
Oh, no, I'm not going to drop.
Okay.
Oh, no, I talked to you earlier about... Oh,
okay. I would have to know why you missed. Oh, an online quiz.
Yeah, the online quiz.
Okay. I think those are going to be calculated into your grade, unless the Blackboard site wasn't working. Then I think I extended the deadline for one quiz because the Blackboard site wasn't working, but. If it was because your computer wasn't working or you forgot the deadline, then you're stuck with those grades.
Okay.
So you'd have to tell me what happened. You know, we can take a look in Blackboard at all your grades and see what maybe what happened during certain periods of time.
Okay.
Maybe during office hours. Can you see me during office hours and we can look at all your grades on Tuesday?
Yeah.
Tuesday morning before lecture?
Okay.
You got a lab done? Tuesday?
No,
oh, good. Okay. So we would have time to take a look at it. Okay. Parker.
Yeah.
Parker Lane.
Yeah.
I know your name. Okay.
Just a quick question. Earlier because I forgot my notes in my car, so I left real quick to go get them and then came back. And then you made an announcement in regard to the test coming up.
Oh, yeah.
I missed that
announcement. Okay. So here is the test on May 8th.
Uh-huh.
We're going to hold it on May 8th, exam number 4.
Mm-hmm.
And we're scheduled for 12, 13, and 14.
Uh-huh.
Okay, but I don't have enough lectures to cover 14 before the test. So it's going to be on 12 and 13.
Okay. And
so that's pretty good. Yeah, that's a good question.
And is 14 going to be moved to...
Yeah, it's going to come down
five,
here.
So 14, 16, 17, 18, and 20.
Yeah. Well, I tell you what, here's a tentative.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say it right now.
Okay.
I'm just really interested in getting through exam 4, and then I'll start thinking about exam 5.
Okay.
So I can't answer completely your question.
Okay, it's fine.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Okay.
I needed to hear that.
Okay.
Hi.
Here. Thank you. We turn these lights on. Yeah. Who is next?
Hewitt.
Okay. Do you want to talk to me in private maybe a little bit? Yeah, that's fine with me.
I'm sorry.
Okay, so Andrea, why don't you come over here? And I'll talk.
That email was so confusing. Was it confusing? Because I meant to put before lab after class, and I put 11 before lab.
I remembered.
Okay.
So that was really good.
So
I printed all your grades. Okay.
Right
from Blackboard. Okay. So when I look at this, I see that we have two exams left.
Mm-hmm.
They're worth 100 points.
Yes.
So that's 200 points left.
Okay.
There are a number of lab quizzes that I don't have grades for. Just a couple.
Okay.
Okay, so there's 75 points left for lab quizzes. And then all the other grades I have entered. Okay. And Blackboard automatically adds all of your scores up and puts it right here. So I know how many points you have in the class.
Okay.
As of right now. There's a couple online quizzes left to do.
Yes.
Yes. There's two. So that's 20 points. So
I'm
if we add up.
10 in those, though.
That's fantastic. Okay. That's nice. Maybe these aren't opened up yet. I'm not sure.
No, they're not.
Okay. So the number of points left in the class is this plus that, which is 295.
I could do that, right?
Okay. So this is just information okay. for you right now. Points left in the class. Okay. The total number of points you can get in the class is 895. So if somebody got 100% on everything, this is what the number of points would be. So for a B, you need 80% of that number. For a C, you need 70% of that number.
Okay.
Okay, so 80% of 895 is 716. All right, so let's just say you're interested in a B. You need 716 points. Okay, 716. But that's at the beginning of the semester. You already have hundreds of points.
Okay.
All right, so now you have 448 points. Let's subtract that from 716. Here's 448 minus 716. That means you only need 267
okay.
needed right now. But what would be really handy to know is, are there more or less points left in the class? If there's less than 267, then you can't get a B. But if there's more, then it's a possibility. So that's why I calculate over here. Yeah.
Okay.
So there's 295 left. So now what would be really interesting to know is what is this percentage compared to that, to know what percentage you have to get on all the remaining work. So that's just 267 divided by 295. That's a 90.8 or 91. To get a B, you need a 90 on all the remaining work, which are these quizzes right here, which you can get hundreds on, these two lecture exams,
okay.
and these lab quizzes.
I need A.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Not a really high A, but some kind of good A.
Okay.
And if you don't get an A on one, then you need to make it up a little bit more on another. The most important items.
Because I know in lab, I'm doing pretty bad in lab.
Okay.
I'm getting a B.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Then you also have to look at the syllabus. The syllabus says something about, I think it says that if you fail lab, then you can't pass the class. Even if you get an A in lecture and you fail lab, you don't pass the class. Yeah.
Oh,
look in the syllabus and see where that is in there. I don't remember the exact wording.
I did not see that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you can't not pass lab but still pass the class. Okay, so make sure you don't get an F in lab.
Sick, so almost a 70.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness, it isn't.
So I got to look at the syllabus. I don't have it to look at.
All right. Okay. Thank you so much.
Okay. So now you know how to calculate it on your own. But if you want me to do it again, I'm happy to do it again.
Okay,
hi.
Hello. I'm sorry I didn't email you. I was
okay.
talking
yeah.
before about
yeah.
I can look through the documentation. My time is on Tuesday.
Yeah. Okay.
And I can give you all the documentation.
I don't need the documentation. I just need the form from DSPS.
Oh,
because I couldn't evaluate any information since that's not my expertise. But if DSPS works with you, then you know I'm more than happy to too, because they're the experts.
Oh, okay. I'm
okay.
Sorry. I'm the drama student.
Okay.
I have my grandma's funeral on Tuesday, and I didn't email you, and I should have. And I'd asked to switch lab days.
Oh,
okay.
So
I have a whole
oh, I see what you're saying. Okay, I see what you're saying.
And I didn't email you beforehand. Uh-huh. This is going to sound like a lie, but I have all of my documentation. My aunt is actually dying too.
Yeah.
Her daughter. And I don't have the flyer for the funeral. I will have it for you on Tuesday.
Okay.
Or even the crematorium paperwork.
Okay.
She was admitted to the hospital the morning of the funeral.
Yeah.
And we almost missed the whole funeral, and she has all the flyers at her house, so that's
okay.
why I don't have it today.
Okay.
But
okay, so let's think about today.
Yeah.
Just focus on today. So you had lab when?
Tuesday.
So Tuesday, you missed that.
That was the day of
and you want to make it up this afternoon.
Yes, and he told me to email you beforehand, which I didn't do, to
okay.
just notify that.
And that instructor is Sidhu. Raj Sidhu is
okay.
doing it today.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I'm going to go up to, and I'll talk to him. I think he's usually there on time. There's one instructor that has trouble getting here on time because he teaches at another campus. But I'll stop in around 1 o'clock and ask him. Okay. And it's okay for you to make up the lab. It's a little bit of a problem because then they have to give a quiz to the other instructor, and sometimes it might get lost or something. Okay.
Is there
so
any
who So who is your, is it Kathleen Sack?
Dr. Lee.
Oh, Lee. Oh, Lee in the afternoon.
In the afternoon. Is there any way that I can just take it on Tuesday? My aunt is like on her deathbed. I didn't know she was going to make it. And I came today.
What do you want to do this afternoon? Do you want to attend lab or not attend lab?
If I have to attend lab, then I will, because I'm dedicated to finishing this class.
Oh, you know what? Okay. I don't think I would like for you to take a quiz, but yet be absent from the class.
Okay.
So, I don't know. My heart is really torn because you're being torn in so many places.
I understand.
Yeah.
I don't want to, put you.
Well, I just feel like I'm beating up on you, though.
No.
So I just don't know if it's good for you to put yourself through that.
I need to finish this class. It's really important.
Mm-hmm.
So I need to do this.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. I think that if you're going to get credit for the quiz, you should attend the lab.
Okay. Absolutely.
Okay. Because, if you don't attend the lab, then that makes you fail the next quiz. So it just kind of snowballs out of control.
Right.
Okay.
So yeah, I will absolutely attend.
Okay. So go upstairs.
Okay.
At 1 o'clock today.
Okay.
And I'll stop up and talk to the instructor.
Okay. Is it the same area?
It's right. It's just right outside by the elevator right there.
Okay.
Okay. Do you know any other students in that lab?
No, I don't.
Okay. I don't know if there's any group activities or anything. Ah, but too bad you don't have a friend in there. But anyway, that's the way it goes.
Okay. Will I take the actual quiz today as well?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Even though I don't, it's a different instructor.
Yeah. Yeah, because I don't want you to get any farther behind.
What about taking the quiz next week? Because, I'm trying so hard to get through this, but I don't know if I can take a quiz today and be able to focus.
Yeah.
I have two family members. I don't even know, how.
Yeah, it's a terrible circumstance to be in.
What happened? Part of life.
Yeah.
I'm just trying. I'm on a leave of absence from work right now. I'm just trying really hard.
Wow, I almost don't know what to say for you.
It's just, I want to be able to take this quiz and successfully pass it.
Yeah.
And it's just, is he on the exact same material? Is it, because, I've been studying, I have all of
the Yeah, the work. Schedule is the same.
Okay.
The schedule is the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
so
I have to do what I have to do.
I think it's best for you to get it out of the way. Yep.
Okay.
Okay. See you upstairs.
Okay.
Okay.